The following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsurup Das Goswami. July 24th, 1993, at Inishroth, Ireland.
Inviting my disciples from Ireland and England as a chance for us to get together and meet a little more intensively than usually may happen as I visit a temple and as you are doing your duties. So I'm glad that Krishna has allowed it to take place, and that Manu and the other devotees here are hosting us. Although it's a meeting with disciples, we're not so sectarian that we're not going to let other devotees attend the classes. But I have a couple of points to make about that, and one is that the flavor will be that addressing disciples in our particular relationship and they addressing me, guru-disciple relationship. So if you want to come, don't be offended that the talk is in this way. And we won't be intimidated either to think, well, I have to make a broader presentation. But we'll keep it in this flavor. And another point is that while anyone can come, it doesn't mean that if somebody is coming, that I, who's not initiated, makes some kind of contract on my part that this is a disciple, because I'm reluctant to enter this relationship on the basis of initiation, but very glad to do the service of teaching as many people as possible what Prabhupada has taught, presenting Prabhupada's shiksha. I wanted it to be more informal than the Srimad Bhagavatam class, and with a little more time also than the Bhagavatam class allows. Although Manu asked me to give the Bhagavatam class tomorrow morning. Also, I didn't want it to be so much a seminar kind of thing. Usually, for me, when I think of giving a seminar, then I can't be satisfied until I have everything planned out exactly like a script, almost word for word, what it's going to be. And the tendency is it's academic. I don't say academic in a derogatory way, but that's one particular classroom. And I wanted it to be more sort of like what's implied by words like workshop or informal discussion, but on substantial topics of Krishna consciousness. This is what would also can be called preaching to devotees, in contrast to preaching to people who are not at all not practicing Krishna consciousness or even perhaps particularly interested in seriously practicing Krishna consciousness. But rather, this is to practitioners. And we have our own particular problems and interests. So I'll be talking of things like chanting and hearing and preaching and being a devotee. And my hope is that it won't be just something that was forgotten, but that it will give you help in your struggle to be a devotee. And I would like devotees to give me their, on a piece of paper, starting right away, whenever you get some idea of something you'd like me to discuss or a question that you'd like to write with a question mark at the end of it. And as these accumulate, I'll start answering them. And in fact, the last morning, I don't have anything prepared except to just answer them. So please, any time you see me or Mother Mongol, and you have some question on a piece of paper, you give it to me and I'll collect them and go over them in advance and then answer them in a future meeting. All right. For this first talk, I wanted to look with you at a section in a book called Madhurya Kandambini by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. This has been circulating in ISKCON for quite a few years, maybe 10 years, in photocopies. And now recently, a new translation, a combined effort by devotees and pandits from ISKCON, Vrindavan, has been published. And it's an improvement over the previous translations. So I expect that some of you have read it and some of you haven't. It's not something to be read once. It's to be read again and again and studied. Very valuable book. I was speaking about preaching to devotees as if this were a specialty of mine, but actually to really be a preacher to devotees, you have to be a master. And the more of a master you are, the more you can speak to the relevant needs of the devotees in a scientific way and bring them step by step. Sometimes we read the exalted and perfect scriptures which have given to us the Puranas or the commentaries by the Goswamis and their various works. And it may seem to us very far away. One devotee was telling me that when I read Srimad Bhagavatam, it seems like a very idealistic world far away. I find it hard to relate to. Of course, the spiritual world is far away from our material minds and material world. But what we sometimes crave and don't always think we find in the scriptures is teachings which come down to our level that have realization of what it's like to be a neophyte, and not just what it was like thousands of years ago, but what it's like particularly now. And do they understand us? Do they understand what we have to go through? And it's assuring when we hear that voice of the teacher on the level of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who in his normal mood he's dwelling at the top of Krishna consciousness in the Leela of Radha and Krishna, but he's compassionate enough and wise to know exactly what are all the steps to get there. So this book is valuable in that way. And I wanted to look at one small section only, near the beginning, which the first time I read it amazed me and never ceases to impress me how he knows our minds and what it's like, how he exposes it. Usually when devotees read this, they either don't know whether to laugh or cry, the way he has exposed our mentalities. So I'll first put this a little on the map of devotional service, the section I'm going to describe. Rupa Goswami has also outlined the steps Krishna consciousness with the very well-known and authoritative steps beginning with Shraddha, Adho Shraddha Tatak Sadhu Sangha Tabhajana Kriya. The steps that go from Shraddha to Prema. And so the first step, the way Prabhupada used to describe them, he would say, the first step is Shraddha or faith. That unless a person has a little faith or even curiosity of a nice kind, then he will not want to hear at all. He won't walk into the Hare Krishna Center or take a book. But someone from previous activities and past lives, he may see the devotional activities of the Krishna consciousness movement and say, let me hear, what are they doing? Let me look at this. That's the initial inquiry. Adho Shraddha Tatak Sadhu Sangha. Then the next step is that he likes something about the introductory taste of Krishna consciousness. Even if there was something awkward, if the book distributor was aggressive or who knows what, the mind finds distasteful in the first contact with devotees. Yet, there was something there that was attractive and one wants to go back and get more. And one wants to associate with serious devotees. When you start to do that, when you associate with sadhus or devotees, that constitutes the second stage. Then, we could say up to now you're sort of independent, you're your own man, your own woman. But now the question of wanting to follow their teachings become submissive to the practices comes up. And so you inquire, what can I do? What do you have to do to be a devotee? And then, so the sadhu will say, well, we chant Hare Krishna on beads, trying to come up to at least a minimum of 16 rounds, and we follow four rules. These are actually the basics practices that if you follow them, they can constitute your eligibility for initiation. So then the person with Shraddha and who has had some association with sadhu says, yes, I would like to do that. I'd like to start practicing what Prabhupada teaches. And then when you take up those practices, that's called bhajana kriya. Now, the section I want to talk about fits in at the beginning of bhajana kriya. The stage after bhajana kriya is called anartha nivritti, and then the stage after that is called nishta. And briefly, anartha nivritti means that by practicing bhajan, your unwanted habits go away as a result of the bhajan. And then you reach a stage where your practice is steady. Nishta means it's very steady and the anarthas are removed. And then you're ready to go on to higher stages. But in bhajana kriya, Vishwanath Chakravarti, he analyzes things a little more finely, a little more closely. So he says that there are two kinds of bhajana kriya. Anasthita, which means unsteady, and nisthita, means steady, like in the word nista. So then actually, the steps, looking at them in a finer division, are after sadhu sangha, first comes anasthita bhajana kriya, that you practice, but you're unsteady. And then after that comes anartha nivritti, and then after that comes nisthita bhajana kriya. So anartha nivritti is actually in the middle of these other two steps. Unsteady practice, then removal of anarthas, and then steady practice. So that means as long as our practice Vajana Kriya is unsteady, we won't be able to remove the anartas. Now, we're going to look at symptoms of anisthita Vajana Kriya, symptoms of unsteady devotional service. In the section of Madhurya Kandimbani where he discusses this, he doesn't immediately say how to overcome each of these, and so I won't either. I think it's good that we get a good look at the symptoms of unsteadiness. One effect this section has on a devotee who reads it is that we are forced to be to consider ourselves in a humble way. I say forced because the presentation is so scientific, according to Bhakti, that we can't bluff it to ourselves and say, oh, I don't have any of these symptoms of unsteadiness, therefore I'm at a more advanced stage than this thing called anisthita bhajana kriya. I've already advanced to anartha nivritti, I've already advanced to nishta. But rather, we will be forced to see ourselves in these descriptions. And then we hope we'll start to really think, how can I improve my life so that I don't have these symptoms? I could do that. I could describe the symptom and then immediately give the theoretical solution. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's good if we just, for a while, just take in the fault finding, saying fault finding in the higher sense, by the acharya, and hear this diagnosis of a poor condition, and. And then think what to do. I'll read each one. There are six stages of unsteady devotional service. And I'll read the definition for each one. And they're actually quite clear. They don't seem to need much elaboration. But I may give a little elaboration. And then before we go on to the next one, if you have any question or discussion about that one, I'll take some questions. Each one of them has a Sanskrit term. The first symptom of unsteady devotional service is called Utsaha Mayi. Utsaha Mayi. A Brahmin child, having just begun study of the scriptures, thinks he has immediately become a learned scholar worthy of everyone's praise. Similarly, a person just beginning devotional service may have the audacity to think that he has mastered everything. This is called Utsaha Mayi, or filled, puffed up with enthusiasm. It may be a little odd to hear this word utsaha mentioned in any kind of negative way, because enthusiasm is the first item of favorable devotional service, and it's always important from beginning to end. Utsaha nishchayat daryat tat tat karma. Rupa Goswami says enthusiasm is most important, and then patience and so on. But utsaha mayi is a different kind of thing. It's a kind of pride. In a sense, it seems sort of understandable. In a human sense, all of these are understandable psychologically. It doesn't mean that because one has these, he's a condemned person or something. So it's to err is human, or to be frail is a human symptom. But still, we have to go above these frailties. So it's understandable that a person coming to Krishna consciousness, learning all these wonderful things, or at least hearing about them in the beginning, and starting, perhaps memorizes some verses, learns how to play the mridanga, and to lecture. Especially we go and we lecture to our parents or to other non-devotees who don't know anything about Krishna consciousness, and compared to them we may think that we're a great pandit or a pure devotee. And we have a kind of enthusiasm, but it's contaminated by thinking that we have mastered Krishna consciousness. He says in translation, he has the audacity to think like this. How could a beginner think he's a master? But that's what happens. That's a maya. Okay, any questions about understanding the definition? Moving on then. Gana Tarala, G-H-A-N-A, Tarala. The same child at times diligently engages in his studies, and yet at other times, due to inability to understand the scriptures or lack of real taste, is negligent. This is the second example where children have been used to give the example. So we're childish in our faults, the way children are immature. The waywardness or the foolishness, the immaturity of a child is a good metaphor for an unsteady devotee in some ways. The same child sometimes likes to do it and sometimes doesn't. Children are whimsical. Due to inability to understand the scriptures or lack of taste, he becomes negligent. In the same way, a new devotee will sometimes practice the different forms of devotional service and at other times neglect them. Being sometimes diligent and at other times negligent, his endeavor is called Gana Tarala, and the literal meaning of the Sanskrit is condensed and dilute, thick, thin. Or we could say hot, cold. Sometimes he's hot, then he cools off. Not interested anymore. Also, in each of these definitions, the expression is a person just beginning, or the new devotee. This may make us think that there's a time limit on this, and after 6 months you're not a new devotee. Certainly after 10 years you couldn't be called a neophyte. Oh no? Oh, new devotee here means someone who's going slowly and is still in the early stages of actual advancement. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can overcome this by hanging around for a certain length of time. So this is a symptom that we can see whether we have this in ourselves. This is like looking in a mirror, and we see some of this in ourselves. We long for the day when we won't be like this, thinking that that I've actually mastered the science of Krishna consciousness, Utsaha Mayi. I don't need to study Bhagavad Gita anymore. And so on. Going back to Utsaha Mayi, I make a comment which is not exactly a definition of Utsaha Mayi, but something that is similar perhaps, is that devotees think that they thoroughly understand ISKCON or the Krishna consciousness movement in a false way, because they learned all the scandals that have happened. They themselves have seen that there's a political level to an institutional level to so many things. And within their temple, they see how to figure out the way things are going on. They know everybody's trip, as we say. And they see the faults and the authorities and so on and so on. They say, I know ISKCON. So that is the kind of education, unfortunately, that you have to go through, which is sometimes is like a disillusioning of a naive idea that everything would be perfect and all the devotees would be perfect. But if you think that this side of things, the worldly, faulty side of things, is the total picture, and that you know what everybody's thinking, you know how advanced everybody is, even the so-called most advanced devotees, then that would be a false understanding, certainly, of what Lord Chaitanya's movement is, of what ISKCON actually is. That could be also a kind of puffed up, hard to call it an enthusiasm, but he might be thinking, almost be enthusiastic about that, about his worldly complete comprehension of everything, whereas actually he doesn't know anything. So then, Ganatarala, hot and cold. Now, next third. Vyudha Vikalpa. Vyudha. Vyudha Vikalpa. Now, this has got a long explanation by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. I'll read it for the most part. And at the end, only he gives more like the literal meaning is extensive speculation. I think when you read it, I also think of the English word indecision or indecisiveness. So this is characteristic. This is speculation, not so much about like we think of speculation about the philosophy, but he's speculating about himself, what he should do in Krishna consciousness. So he displays an indecisiveness. And this in this one particularly, Vishwanath Chakravarti has focused in on the mind of such a devotee. So it's in quotes. This is the mind of the devotee who has this vyudha vikalpa. He thinks like this. Shall I just spend my life happily in family life, making my wife and children Krishna conscious and worshipping the Lord? Or should I give them all up and go to Vrindavan to perfect myself by engaging full time in hearing and chanting with no distractions? Shall I wait till the last stage after enjoying all sorts of pleasures? And I finally understood that the whole material world is simply a forest fire of affliction. Or is it better that I renounce right now? Then he says, consider these verses. He quotes a verse from Srimad Bhagavatam. Association with a woman is the way to death, like a blind well covered by grass. Another verse. Those attachments that are very difficult to give up, beautiful wife, obedient sons, devoted friends, vast empire, everything the heart desires. Maharaj Bharat gave them up like stool, even in his youth, due to his attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Uttama Shloka. Should I thus give up unreliable family life while still young? On the other hand, it's not proper to renounce immediately. Shouldn't I wait till the death of my old parents before renouncing? Then he quotes Srimad Bhagavatam again. Alas, my parents are old and my wife is with a mere infant in her arms and other young children. Without me, they will have no protection and will suffer unbearably. How will they live without me? And he thinks again. Besides, if one gives up family life in an unsurfeited state, his mind will constantly dwell on family life even after renouncing. So he quotes another verse. Being unsatisfied and always thinking of his family members, he dies and enters the darkness of ignorance. By such statements of the Lord, I can see that I don't have the strength for renunciation, so for the time being, I'll just work to keep my body alive. Later, after satisfying my desires, I'll enter Vrindavan and engage in the worship of the Lord 24 hours a day. After all, the scripture points out, then he quotes, Jnana and Vairagya are not beneficial in the practice of devotional service. According to this verse, renunciation is a fault for the culture of bhakti. If it arises from bhakti itself, however, that renunciation is not a fault, but an effect of bhakti and subordinate to it. He's just going back and forth, on this one point. Although you could do it on other things too, but he's thinking, this is a grihastha thinking, should I immediately get out of household life? And there are examples and evidence that this can be done. Or if I did it, in my case, would it be premature, and then I'd get in trouble later, even worse. So you can find scriptures that back up different things, and so he just can't make up his mind. But you could also go through this routine with something else, like should I do one kind of service or another kind of service? Or if someone is unmarried, should they get married or should they not get married? Too much of this is a distraction, and this is something that's indulged in by a devotee in the stage of unsteady bhajana kriya. So he continues. This is called the chariot of the mind, hovers back and forth. Let's see, where do we leave off? Oh, now he's saying that better that he not better not renounce prematurely. Of course, there is the logic. In whatever ashram the sannyasi stayed, he always got more than enough to eat. In a life of renunciation, there's no worry for maintenance, so maybe I should renounce. But on the other hand, and then he quotes Srimad Bhagavatam, my dear Lord Krishna, until people become your devotees, their material attachments remain thieves, their homes remain prisons, and their affectionate feelings for their family members remain foot shackles. Household life is a prison only for those who are attached. For a devotee, there is no harm in household life. Thus shall I remain at home and engage in chanting, or rather in hearing, or shall I engage in service? Yes, and even if he decides one thing to do, he'll still be on the mental plane. All right, I'll stay home, I'll stay in household life, and I'll chant. Or maybe I shouldn't chant, maybe I should read. Maybe I shouldn't just read and chant, I should do service. And perhaps sometimes he's decided on one and then think, yes, this is it, this is it, this is it, and then he goes on to another one. Rather, as Ambarish Maharaj remained in household life and performed all the angas of bhakti, I shall do likewise. In this way, the mind spends time vacillating between the life of renunciation and household life, considering the different options. This is called Vyudha Vikalpa, or extensive speculation. It's one thing to go through a process of pro and con and make some serious decision in life. We have to do that. But this kind of thing, this is an unfortunate state that can just consume all your time and energy. And it doesn't appear to be particularly pleasing to Krishna. It's not like an offering. It's not a nice offering to Krishna that you're just vacillating all the time and don't have any time to offer him something nice with a wholehearted, single-minded devotion. Okay. Now the fourth. Vishaya Sangara. Means struggle with sense pleasure. Vishaya refers to the senses or sense gratification. Vishaya chariya kabe Naratam Das Thakur sings it. If I want to enter Vrindavan, I have to give up Vishaya, attachment to sense gratification. So Sangra means struggle. So this person, he's on a battlefield, and his particular war or struggle is with the senses. He starts out with a quote. One whose heart is absorbed in materialism is far from obtaining devotion to Vishnu. Can a man, by going east, obtain something that is in the west? Seeing that material enjoyment is forcibly carrying him away and impairing his steadiness in serving Krishna, the devotee resolves to renounce his addictions and take shelter of the holy name. But many times his attempts at renunciation often end in enjoying what he's trying to renounce. Such a person is exemplified in the Bhagavatam, in the quote from the Bhagavatam. Having awakened faith in topics about me, my devotee is disgusted with all material activities, knowing that sense gratification leads to misery. Still, though he tries, he is unable to give up his material desires and sometimes engages in the same sense enjoyment that brings only misery. But repenting such activities, he should worship me with love, faith, and firm conviction. So this is different than the non-devotee who has dedicated his life and is planning his whole life out for sense gratification as the goal. That person is not engaged in any kind of war with the senses. He's just enjoying the senses, he thinks. Although it becomes, for him, a source of misery, he doesn't know that his misery is due to sense gratification. He thinks, I just don't have the right partner for my sense gratification. Or I just don't have enough money for sense gratification. I'm taking the wrong kind of intoxicants. I have the wrong kind of car. But if I could get it together, then I could enjoy sense gratification. Or I'm trying to enjoy sense gratification in ignorance. I should try in passion. I should try in goodness. His whole plan is always sense gratification. That's different. This is a devotee who knows that sense gratification ruins my devotional service, as in the verse, that I want to go east, but how can I go east? How can a man, by going east, get something that is in the west? If I go in the direction of sense gratification, it stops my devotional service. But I can't help myself. So there are sincere devotees who just cannot control sex desire, or usually that one, but maybe something else. Maybe they maybe have an intoxication habit. And so they try and practice for some time, giving it up, but it's a war all the time. And they lose in this war, or they lose battles, and then after losing a battle, they fall down in illicit sex, and then say, now, I feel very bad about this. I cannot make advancement now. I must make advancement in Krishna consciousness and give this up. And so, this is their main struggle. The person who is Vishaya Sangara. Vishwanath Chakravarti says, this ongoing battle with his desires for sense enjoyment from former habit, where he sometimes meets with victory and sometimes with defeat, is called Vishaya Sangara, or struggle with sense pleasure. So just as in the material world, when there is war in the country or between countries, then all normal proceedings are disrupted, everything is devastated, everything goes into the war effort, all the money goes into the war effort, and normal life of happiness and education and family peace is disrupted. So the normal activities of devotional service in a similar way get disrupted in a devotee who is always at war with the senses. And at any time he can be defeated and then have to go back again to the beginning. Now, the next one is called Niyama, Niyamakshama. N-I-Y-A-M-A-K-S-A-M-A. Niyamakshama. Pronounced. Niyamakshama is the inability to improve his devotional service. The word niyama, we hear Prabhupada reciting the Eightfold Yoga System, and the first one is niyam-yam. Niyam-yam, then asan, sitting posture, pranayam, breathing, and so on. Well, the first step is called niyam-yam, which means following rules and regulations. Or the word vow is implied, that you you take vows of make resolves of what you're going to do. So this person has a problem with these vows. Then the devotee will resolve, from today I will chant such and such number of rounds of japa, and I will pay so many obeisances. I'll also perform services for the devotees. I won't talk about anything except the Lord, and I'll give up all association with people who talk gossip. Though the devotee makes such resolutions every day, he is not always able to carry them out. This is called niyamakshama, or inability to follow rules. The previous problem, vishaya sangara, is the ability to give up sense enjoyment, while niyamakshama is the ability to improve his devotional service. So you may have the senses, at least externally, under control, following the four rules, all right, no problem. So, but you cannot be steady in other ways. And it becomes a farce that you make these resolutions. This seems to imply personal vows, aside from when we take initiation, we vow to follow the four rules and 16 rounds. But sometimes the devotees make plans or make vows to improve or to increase. That it would be good if I increased my rounds. And then they do it for a couple of days, but then you get sick. So that while I was sick, I couldn't chant my extra rounds. That's understandable. But then I never go up again to the vow that I made a few days ago. Or I say, I'm going to make a vow, I'm going to read an hour a day. And then you do it for a while, and then a busy season comes in your devotional life. Well, I have to drop that, but I'll get back to it later. And you never get back to it later. So there are, quote, good, unquote, reasons why we can't keep our vows. But if we would stop and look over all these vows and resolutions and how they're all just like litter, torn and lying around in our lives, and nothing was ever followed. It's not just due to the circumstances we live in, but we are unsteady persons in Bhajana Kriya. And the last one is called Taranga Rangini. Ranga means pleasure, where you seek pleasure. Taranga refers to waves. Like in the ocean, there are little waves. So I'll read it. Finally, it is well known that the very nature of bhakti is to be attractive. Thus, many people become attracted to the devotee, the abode of bhakti. And, as the old adage goes, by the public's attraction, one becomes wealthy. Bhakti produces much opportunity for material gain, worship, and position. Labha, puja, pratishta. These are weeds around the creeper of bhakti. Seeking one's pleasure, ranga, amidst these weed-like facilities, which are but small waves, taranga, in the ocean of bhakti, is called taranga rangini, delighting in material facilities. So, if we were to ask ourselves, or if somebody were to ask us, What is your realization of bhakti? You've been practicing it for some time. What is your realization? We may think, well, you don't have much realization. It remains theoretical for us. What is Krishna? What is the nectar of the holy name? But one thing we would have to say that we have realized is that when you practice bhakti, people will give you money, and people will regard you as religious, and there are opportunities, if you practice bhakti for a while, that people will give you honor and position. And so one may say, I realize this about bhakti, that you can get the good, that you get material facilities if you practice Krishna consciousness. Because although it's a cynical age, many people don't like devotees, but there are pious people, and they will support devotees. And then among the congregation or the practicing devotees, they will give honor. They'll give honor just on the basis of seniority to other devotees. And if a devotee shows some talent or ability in Krishna consciousness, they'll give him position and so on. So these are material facilities, because devotees should have material facilities also, so that he can spread Krishna consciousness. But if we get caught up in enjoying these facilities, which are described like they're little insignificant waves in the ocean, then we don't get to enjoy or take pleasure in the essence of the of love of God, what it really is to serve the Lord and the Vaishnavas, to chant and hear, because we've put our heart, we've invested our devotional careers in getting this pleasure from this insignificant pleasure of the material benefits that come from practicing Krishna consciousness. So that's certainly an unattractive symptom of someone who's practicing devotional service. It doesn't mean that you cannot accept these things, but you should do so not deriving pleasure from it, but just doing it for your service. Or you give it to Krishna, you give it to the spiritual master, and you go on working hard in his service and trying to taste the real nectar, not these little waves. So these are the six symptoms of unsteady devotional service. And the topic, then he goes on in Madhurya Kandambini. In the next chapter, he discusses in detail anartas, unwanted habits, aparads, offenses. But then after a few chapters, or at the third chapter, after that chapter, he comes back again to discuss a little bit the anishta bhajan, anistita bhajan. So he recommences the discussion in a later chapter and says, previously in the discussion of the two types of bhajana kriya, anistita and nistita, the six types of anistita bhajana kriya were described. And then he explains that after describing unsteady devotional service, he went on to describe anartha nivritti, the stage in which you get rid of the anarthas. And now he'll come back to discuss the advanced stage of bhajana kriya, steady devotional service. There are many interesting topics. I'm not trying to make an overview of this whole book, but it's hard to resist some of it. It's so nice. Just to give you a little taste, you can study yourself. Srimad Bhagavatam verses. He describes two verses and how they fit into this scheme of unsteady and steady devotional service. One verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a well-known verse, describes the state of the stage of unsteady devotional service, and that's this one. Shrinvita Svakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Viriyantak Stoya Bhadrani Virunoti Suritsitam. Lord Krishna, who is in the heart of the devotee, cleanses auspicious elements from the hearts of the devotees who have developed the urge to hear his messages. So this, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti, this refers to a preliminary stage of devotional service whereby practicing chanting and hearing, Krishna removes some of the dirty things in your heart, but it's only a preliminary stage. And in that stage, you don't have so much taste, and you still have these six symptoms that we just described. So again, these problems, these are not problems of non-devotees. These are problems of devotees, problems of good people, problems of sincere bhaktas. It doesn't mean that because we become devotees, we're perfect. Therefore, what does it mean that we're not perfect? This is what it means, what we've just described. These are the faults that a devotee still has until the devotee becomes perfect. So we have so much work to do to remove all these things to even get to the beginning stages. If this is actually a mirror, if you've identified with these things that I read and said, yes, that's me, I can't make up my mind, that's me, I'm trying to enjoy the results of devotional service. That's me, I make a vow and I can't follow it. That's me, I'm in a big war with the senses and sometimes I fall down and I get back again. Then it means that we're at a very early stage of devotional service. So then he says another verse describes the stage of anartha nivritti, and that's Nasta Praisu Abhadre Su Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavata Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naistiki. And that verse says that by hearing the Bhagavatam and serving the Bhagavat devotee, almost all the inauspicious things get removed. So there's a more removal of dirty things and more steadiness is exemplified in that verse. But we could never understand these meanings of the Bhagavatam except for acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti. He makes a list now of some more unsteady symptoms. And I think these, again, this is like a... I read this, it was like a mirror, again. So he's describing nishta. Nishta means to have the quality of steadiness, or naishchalyam, non-movement. Though a person tries for steadiness every day, when the anarthas are still present, he will not attain it. So... although I'm not going to discuss what anarthas are, I expect many of you already know what it means, certain bad habits or aparads, like to commit offense to the holy name, to commit offense to the Vaishnavas, etc. So many aparads and anarthas. As long as you have them, then you'll have these unsteady symptoms that we discussed. There's a connection. When you get rid of the anarthas partially, then you can start to be somewhat steady. When you get rid of them more, you can be more steady. So there's a direct correlation between anarthas and aparads and being either unsteady or steady. So what he mentions here now is five persistent obstacles that come when you try to... when you're directly practicing the bhajan. The six that we mentioned, they seem to be like overall... attitudes or failings in life that I can't control my senses and so on. But now he talks about when you specifically say go to chant japa or hear Srimad Bhagavatam or perform any devotional service, that you meet with five persistent obstacles and you can't do it nicely and you can't taste it. These are due to having anarthas and aparads, but they take these forms. Laya, sleep. Vikshepa, distraction. Apraptipati, indifference or disinterest in spiritual topics. So, again, this is not the disinterest of a non-devotee. I want to be interested, but I can't. I just can't get really interested in the discussion or in the subject or the practice, my own practice. I'm distracted. I'm sleepy. Rasasvada, taste for material enjoyment. I still have, when I try to practice, even at that time, when I'm trying to appreciate Krishna, on my mind is different material enjoyment that I'd like to be doing. And so I cannot concentrate. After the stage of anartha nivritti, when these obstacles are almost completely destroyed, one achieves steadiness. Thus, the symptom of nishta is the absence of these five obstacles. So it's getting a little technical. Also, it's not so long after breakfast to realize maybe not the most alert time of the day. I don't want to get too technical, but he is wrapping up all the points here, so I don't want to leave them unraveled. If someone asks you what is nishta, which in one word is steadiness, the further understanding of it is that it means when you practice your sadhana and you don't have these five obstacles, then you can be said to be steady. And they are that you're sleepy, that you're distracted, you're not interested in it, you're indifferent toward it, you have an interest in material things. I left one out. You have a tendency toward bad habits from the past. So this, how important is it to be steady and overcome these things? Very important. It's the whole. It's the measure of your success in bhakti. And he, just to impress how important it is to be steady in your practices, he makes a comparison at the end of this chapter to elements which are favorable to bhakti and which they're very highly admired by everyone. But he says these things aren't as important as to be steady in devotional service. He says, elements favorable to bhakti refer to humility, giving respect to others, friendliness and mercifulness. At times, one may see steadiness in such qualities in a self-controlled devotee who has no steadiness in bhakti, whereas elsewhere one may not perceive steadiness in these qualities in an arrogant devotee who has attained steadiness in bhakti. In spite of this, by the presence or absence of steadiness in bhakti, rather than in the qualities of bhakti, learned wise men understand the actual presence or absence of nishtha. So this is a delicate point. I wouldn't want somebody to mishandle it. But it actually means that the most important thing is your ability to practice chanting and hearing, and that's more important than other qualities. Those other qualities will come, but the most important thing is to develop a taste and a steady practice of devotional service. For example, when we consider whether a devotee is ready for initiation, I may ask the temple president if somebody's. We ask, are they following the four rules? They're able to give up illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, gambling. They must be doing these. It's very important. And also, they must be chanting their 16 rounds. But even more important than that is, do they have faith in the holy name? Do they have faith in the devotees, in Krishna? Certain practices and qualities are important, but even more important is the basic attitude towards Krishna consciousness. In a similar way, although these other things, friendliness, mercifulness, humility, are very important, if they would be present in the person and he didn't really want to practice Krishna consciousness, then we wouldn't call those qualities don't equal bhakti in themselves, but they're very favorable and necessary to bhakti. Therefore, we should appreciate anybody who wants to practice Krishna consciousness, even if they don't show all these nice qualities. They will show these qualities if they continue to practice. In summary, what has been shown is that laxity or intensity of effort, as well as difficulty or ease in hearing, chanting, and doing other devotional service, are the criteria for determining the two types of bhakti, namely unsteady and steady. So you can boil it down that if you find it very hard to chant and hear and do your service, that means it's unsteady. If you find that it's easy, you just flow with it, you like it, then these are symptoms of steadiness. Or if you're lax about your rounds and your hearing and your other service, this is a sign that it's unsteady. If you're not lax, but rather you're intense and you're into it, then you're steady. though we may all admit that we've got some unsteady elements, and now I hope we can see them more clearly what they are. Only when you really can see a problem clearly are you in a position to do something about it. We may have just had like a vague idea. Well, I'm in Krishna consciousness. I'm in ISKCON. I'm doing what they say to do. So I guess I'm all right. I don't know whether I'm all right or not, but I guess I'm all right. But it shouldn't be so vague. Any questions or comments? I guess we're always dealing with the remedies, but no, I thought I'd just spend most time on saying what the problems were. Yeah, I'll be dealing with the remedies in the next classes, but we can deal with it now if you like, or we can discuss it.
There's one point there on the Vishaya Sagara, the struggle for senses, and I just have a question about that, in that it, I hope it's not unsympathetic, because I know I'm also struggling with the senses as well. But sometimes we see that a person who's taken to devotional service and has a lot of problems with struggling with the senses, and in one sense, when he sees it, sort of it's given a sort of a position in the whole, you know, in Vishwanath's six different problems, and that you might sort of think that it's like in one sense that he can take it easy, or see, in sometimes I have to in my particular position I have to say that okay, this doesn't go. I'm not allowing this. This isn't right. Like this, maybe some person might be taking the tops against or something. But it's sincere and wants to sort of do something, but can't help this. And then I'm just wondering, am I being committing an apparat by saying no? Well, you can't stay in the temple. You've got to stay here. You've got to stay. Mm. You know, there's lots of instances that would be like that.
Well, first of all, it's you said it. Like this is this description gives the person a position. Well, these are not items of prestige. They can say, well, I can't control my senses, but that's Vishwanath Chakravarti has called that Vishaya Sangara, so this is within devotional service, you know. Rather, it's a bad thing. It's an unfortunate thing that's stated. Not a position to be proud of. I'll eventually. After all, I didn't claim that I'm in the stage of Ruchi or Bhava. But as you say, there's like standards that if you don't follow the four rules, then you cannot live in the temple, or you cannot do this or that. So you should have compassion for everybody, even people who don't follow rules and regulations. We want to give them Krishna consciousness, but there's a difference between eligibility to take different services, or to like who can go on the altar, who can offer food to Krishna, who can give a lecture, and who can live in the temple, and so on. This is a serious disqualification, and you're entitled as a manager, not entitled, but it's your responsibility to exclude persons who are still having this struggle from certain privileges or duties. At the same time, not just excluding them, but trying to help them and find out what they can do. I see that the GBC made some resolutions this year of actually giving like Vaishnava names and categories to people who are not ready for initiation, a person who he chants but he can't follow the four rules, or he's called or something, a bhakta such and such, and it's giving recognition that this person, he's come a long way, he's not a karmi, he likes Krishna, he likes the holy name, but he cannot control his senses, and he's some kind of a devotee, so he's cannot be initiated, but he's called a friend of the sadhu or something like that. And the person becomes a little encouraged. I think that's the psychology behind it. They said, well, I am part of the congregation of Krishna consciousness. I cannot follow all the rules and regulations. But it shouldn't be that kind of accommodation of persons. We have to be careful about it. Like one of the categories was a person who he does not commit illicit sex outside of marriage. He has he's just only within marriage, but he cannot follow the rules of marriage. So that is not sanctioning that, but it's recognizing this person, he's come a long way. He should be given some kind of credit. But what the credit is, or what he can do, and so on, that has to be clear. Reduction? You did have a question? Yeah.
Terminology that we use, devotees use sometimes, we confuse steadiness with regulation. Sometimes we think we're steady, or we say we're steady, but we're not actually steady because we're regulated to do a limited amount of things.
Yeah.
But not, so,
I think. Yeah, this gives us a deeper meaning of steady than having good attendance on the job and so on. Being regulated, yeah, he may be so-called steady, but just every day it's the same. The japa session is the same abominable failure, with these five impediments very strong, and all other anarthas are still present. So that wouldn't be steady. That's a good point. That the English word that we use steady to describe this. Sanskrit word anisthita bhajanakriya. Anisthita, we shouldn't take it just to mean that appearance of steadiness by regulation. But yeah, it's a deep thing that he's free of so many problems to be actually called steady. And when you become steady, then it opens the door. You're going to go on to the next higher and higher stages, like taste, ecstasy, attraction. So this kind of steadiness is something very wonderful. We even use the word in a negative way that somebody is consistent in his bad habits. You know, again he's arrogant. Again he failed to do this. And say, well, at least he's consistent. We say satirically, but we don't mean that it's a virtue. It's a steady rascal. So it doesn't mean just consistency in performance, but it's a quality.
Just on that same point, that seems to be like an underlying theme which you've been talking about. It's like a summary at the end. Krishna Chakravarti was talking about the laxity and extent of endeavor to be used to judge the practice of devotional service.
Yeah.
But you could say, like when the very first one you mentioned, was the Hamayi, false enthusiasm, there could be a lot of endeavor at that stage.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not. So there's something, there's an underlying theme, like you said, of quality.
Yeah, purity.
It's to be strived for. It's not just some superficial thing.
Yeah.
Or if I'm working very hard, or.
Yeah.
The example that the reduction just gave about steady and regular.
Yeah.
The same thing. There may be a lot of, there may be a large extent.
Yeah. Also, Manu has brought up a good point, which is the social acceptance or attitude, not among ourselves, either by authority in a temple to the others, or just among equals. How do we, so there shouldn't be, this is not for condemnation, that I see in your enthusiasm the imperfection of your thinking that you have mastered Krishna consciousness. Like anything, it's mostly for ourselves that we should read this and see, I am enthusiastic and that's good. People even praise me that I'm working hard, I'm endeavoring. But I see that I work hard, but I have this puffed up idea that I know everything about Krishna consciousness, or I'm always trying to enjoy what comes. So others may point it out, but we should learn it ourselves. So yes, the quality or the purity is what's being referred here. Otherwise, as you say, intensity can be there, but it's still with some big faults. Then that's not the kind of intensity he refers to. But it's again about steadiness, the meaning of the word steadiness. There is a quality being admired, if we can attain it, and sought for, where you do consistently keep a decent level of your devotional service, and that it's a real sign of unsteadiness in the context of this discussion when you keep going down. I think you could apply this to anything that you do. So there's certainly a virtue in that I do make resolutions and I keep them. The initiation vows, I always keep them. I never have failed to keep them, and so on. So that's part of the quality, also. Whereas we see like this Ganatarala. Sometimes thick, sometimes thin. But the steady person, he's always reading and chanting. And the one who's struggling with the senses sometimes follows the four rules, sometimes doesn't. No, he always does because he's steady. So quality means consistency also. Not sometimes I'm into Krishna, like somebody... really non-committed person. Sometimes they're into Krishna consciousness and sometimes they're not at all. Well, we hate to think that we are like that, but we may be. So steadiness will mean that I'm always into Krishna consciousness. This is my life and I'm dedicated. Anyone else? Yes. In one sense, it's hard because association, maybe nectar devotion, it's like a crystal. That whatever color you put next to the crystal, it becomes like that. So if you associate a lot with a cynical person, cynical towards ISKCON, and then you start thinking like that or speaking like that, then maybe that is, you should try to minimize that association or try to elevate it. For example, or you might say be selective in how you associate with them. There might be a time that they particularly like to do that, like when they're just sitting and relaxing and talking, or so you can avoid the kind of association when that side of them comes out, but say to them, why don't we read the Bhagavatam together, or why don't we chant japa together, or why don't we work together, and so that you don't have to hear all this cynical talk that they have to make. And in a gentle way, you could try to correct it also, and say, if your relationship is a little bit developed, you can say, Prabhu, you know, you always talk about the wrongs in ISKCON, they're certainly there, but I think we have to also appreciate that it's just a wonderful thing that Prabhupada has been able to preach all over the world, and that people are taking to it, and so many wonderful things are being done. Try to bring out the positive and the deeper aspects that the person is neglecting by always talking about the politics and what's wrong. Makes gentle suggestions that this kind of talk is kind of a bring down, doesn't really improve anything. If you find yourself being too affected, then you have to think, do I really need that association? Mano?
Yeah, I was going to say how valuable actually this delineation is of the different things. Because even this one, the number six terms are convenient, and we see some of the false, maybe the devotee, somebody who seems to be, at one time he's taken maybe pleasure, also ourselves as well, we might be guilty of this too, but some of the sleeping pleasure, and perhaps the more material, smaller gains. And like, we may feel sort of very negative towards that person for doing that, or really go come down heavy on a person, but actually, at other times, I found myself doing that one time quite recently with a devotee, because I thought that I was seeing sort of that type of activity in the person. But then afterwards I talked to him again, and then he started to exhibit much different qualities, very advanced qualities, which very much impressed me. Mm. And it sort of changed my whole attitude. And when you hear things like this, it makes you think that, like, not everything that's on the surface is what you should be judging by,
mm-hmm.
but that there may be some surface things which aren't so good.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Maybe so much else there.
Yeah. And that's that one hears these things and then goes around with the book in hand and says, you. even if you do see that person is displaying the symptoms of indecision, that's not all they're displaying. They're also displaying surrender in so many ways. But like someone like Vishwanath Chakravarti, he's not being cruel or unfair or anything. He's just saying, this is it. He's not saying, if you have this, you'll go to hell. If you have this, I hate you. If you have this, you can't be in the kirtan. But he's saying, in a cool-headed way, this is a science. These are symptoms. If you're not very advanced, you probably have these problems. Now you be truthful to yourself and study this and admit it. So we should also be like scientific or factual, not sentimental, and be the first to admit that we have problems ourselves and we're trying to advance. Yeah, this is not the whole story. But this is a stage. And it gets, another way to look at it is that it's going to get better and better when we get rid of these things. Then there's so much more ahead. This is the beginning, and we're at the beginning. But it's not that we always just stay with all these problems. We go on practicing; these things will disappear. They're problems of neophytes, and I will not remain a neophyte. Then I'll start in, really, instead of being in the wave, the tiny insignificant waves, I'll get into the ocean. I'll start being more decisive. I don't want to be indecisive. And so on. I think it's good. If I go to chant and I see, oh, there's sleepiness, there's indifference. They're like my enemies. Like Arjuna said, where are the enemies, Krishna? I want to know where they are so I can see them in the battle. So now we can see what they are. And not delude ourselves, but know, and then try to improve. That's why he does it, not to disappoint anybody. or to cut anybody down, but to help us to advance. All right, I'll end it here. So we're going to be meeting twice a day. In the evenings, I want to have time for talking, but also kirtan, and one night japa kind of workshop. So what is it? 5 o'clock. And so if you have any things you'd like me to talk about, or any questions, please give them in. And if anyone, if anyone wants to write me a letter about any other topics that you would like me to address, not in this class, of course, I don't even have to say that. You already know that I look forward to the personal correspondence. All right. Thank you very much.